This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Xiao Yik. Today is our Doctor in the House segment with my co-host, consultant neurologist, Dr. George Lee. How are you today, George?
I'm very happy. You know, obviously, it's another Friday. We're looking forward to the weekend and we're looking forward to a fresh topic today.
Yeah, something very, very interesting. And I think we have touched on it for the show before, but it's always good to come back to it again and get different perspectives.
Indeed.
And today's perspective, very interesting. Interesting, because we have somebody who's not a medical person joining us, one of those rare occasions, Dr. Aisha Syed, a senior lecturer at the Faculty of Languages and Linguistics at University of Malaya. And, you know, you're going to be wondering, why are we talking to somebody who's a linguistics expert? You'll find out in a short while.
She'll probably correct us a lot as well.
But also, we do, of course, have the clinical perspective from you, George, and from a second-year dental student, Stephanie Hui. So, you know, of course, when we're talking about healthcare, the services provided by a healthcare professional, we value their qualifications, your experiences, of course. But beyond that, we talk about that bedside manner, right? And we want a provider, whether you're a doctor, a urologist, a dentist, or our GP, to treat us as an individual, to understand us and what we're afraid of, what kind of pain we're feeling, rather than just looking at us as a set of symptoms.
Problems. That needs to be resolved, right? You know, it's whole idea of empathy, being affable, right? You know, Shari, when I left medical school, one of my professors gave me a piece of advice and said, do you know what makes a successful doctor? And then I said, no. He said, there's three A's. Number one, it's affable. You're likable, and then that's a good one. Number two, it's available. Make sure that you're always there. So with recent travelling, I'm not that available.
Oh, dear.
And the third one is able. So it's in that order. It's that whole idea of being approachable, affable, and then that itself will put a lot of mind at ease, and because a lot of that will be the first step to a better healing, really.
So we want to understand, what does empathy look like in that healthcare setting, but also where does language, communication and linguistics come into it? And of course, that perspective of training, and that's why we do have Stephanie, the dental student, joining us today. Maybe we can... you know, you've already offered the three A's, George, and I love that. So perhaps I can hear from you, Aisha, in terms of, you know, linguistically, perhaps, that word empathy. What does that mean? And then in the doctor-patient context, what does it mean?
Okay, thanks, Sharik. I really like the three A's that Dr. George has brought up. And I think if you look at each of them, you can see how you can't really demonstrate any of those without language, right? And that kind of explains the kind of role of a linguist, or why me as a discourse analyst, why I work with healthcare and what I look at. Particularly, there's so many aspects of healthcare discourse, but my main focus is on the communication or interaction between doctors and patients, dentists and patients, and so on. So empathy, there's so many different ways of looking at it. And this is widely discussed in the literature. When we talk about empathy, we think we're talking about an emotion. And that gives us certain problems, right? Like, how do we assess it? How do we measure it? But I think more and more, and people in my area especially are more focusing on the communicative performance of it. What types of linguistic actions, or what type of communication we can tie to our understanding of what empathy is. Because although we've got surveys and things to measure empathy, we don't really know whether, one, people's responses are stable, whether a response on a survey is actually measuring something internal, but we can empirically look at communicative practices. And I think most people would know this description of empathy, you know, putting yourself in someone else's shoes, right? To distinguish it from sympathy. But when we look at very specific interactional actions, for example, firstly, letting them talk to hear about their perspective. And there we can look at doctor patient-centered types of communicative strategies, like eliciting patient perspectives, using open-ended questions. Because if you don't know a person's point of view, then how are you going to empathize with it, it in the first place? But there are also very specific types of communicative actions, like reformulating what they have said to you to show that you understand it. Caring type of discourse, as in when somebody is telling you a particular about a particular story or their emotions or something that is not necessarily clinical, making a space for them to talk and showing it's important. So I, as a discourse analyst and a linguist, would tend to focus more on that part of empathy, as in how do we do it? What kind of talk is empathetic? And there's a lot of overlap with patient-centered communication as well, I think.
What do you think, George, in your practice? Is it about that kind of talk? Is it the words, the caring, the reformulating? I mean, she's brought up so many things, right? Seeing things from the patient's perspective. How about for you, empathy? Mm-hmm. What does it look like?
Well, Shawik, I mean, I was raised and went to medical school in a really traditional medical school. I went to Cambridge and none of these were part of the curriculum. Communications and that sort of thing is completely out of window. It's just basically your knowledge and how you convey that knowledge to another person is what is focused on. However, when I became a clinical associate professor locally, I realized that the part of communication, the most important part of communication, is not what I convey to the person. It's actually the active listening. I think one thing that a lot of people don't do is, as a clinician myself, is actually don't actively listen, because you listen, you hear what people say. But when you actively listen, you put yourself immersed in it, understanding it. And I think in my own experience, I only learned it much, much later on in my academic life, is that active listening. I don't know what Aisha and also Stephanie think about it, but I regretted early on in my career that it was all that conveying your messages, making sure that everything I say to a patient, you understand it. Mm. But the reality is that you need to listen first to understand it, right?
Mm-hmm. And Stephanie, you are currently in the training system. So what is it? Is it what George depicted, or have things progressed? And is there more focus on communication in terms of your medical training right now?
Actually, we had a course. It's like an English communication course for us when I was in year one. Last year, and this communication in English course taught us how to use the open-ended questions and then train us to be more open up and, not afraid to be sociable, and teach us some sort of techniques to talk to the older adults and the younger children. Yeah.
Older adults and younger children particularly. Yeah. All right. And do you think that was helpful, number one? And number two, do you think it's sufficient to just do it in the first year of your medical course? And, it's going to be years before you then go out and practice.
So to answer the first question, I think it is quite useful for me as year one and year two student, because we have to get to train ourselves in the first 2 years of the dental curriculum in order to treat our patients in year three onwards. But I don't think that is sufficient for us yet, since we actually had it online instead of physically last year due to the MCO. So I think there's much more improvement to do.
Is this something you can teach, George?
I think definitely. I mean, I don't want to say that, some people just don't have it, some people just have it. I liked the way Stephanie said about how they focus on specific people which need a special skill of that communication. But I really think essentially how we communicate it, apart from linguistically, it also involves your body language and all that thing. I really can empathize with Stephanie saying that how what sort of challenges, obstacles she faced if this was actually conveyed on the screen. However, I think, to answer your question indirectly, it is something that you can teach and learn. However, for some individuals, it may take longer. However, it's a life journey process. I mean, for me, I'm still learning the whole idea of body language. How do you convey bad news? How do you gauge fear whenever you try to discuss certain diagnoses? And all that are all a learning process that I go through, and it's all picking up the cues. And so in a way, I'm not formally learning it for someone expert like Aisha. However, every time I realize I made a mistake, let's say, for example, picking up the wrong cue or anything like that, I really realize that I won't make the same mistake again. Mm-hmm. And I really think that I'm hoping that Stephanie will pick up these foundations. I think that's crucially important. However, it's just something that I think Stephanie should carry on in her career to enhance and also fine-tune that communication skill.
Mm. And Aisha, you know, you've sort of only talked about it from that definition perspective, but then bringing in how you see this being built into training, curriculum, and really the lifelong on-the-job learning that George described. What are your thoughts on that?
Okay, first of all, Stephanie is in year two right now. So they're preclinical students. So I think what they were trying to do is give them prior exposure to communication. Like Dr. George said, you really do have to do the practical thing and actually start actually talking to patients. And I think that's where most of the learning takes place. But rather than wait until they're in their clinical years, I think that is why the dental program is trying to expose them beforehand. And also that's why we chose the year one, year two students for our project. One thing about linguists, right? We're not necessarily there involved as to assess and say whether it's right or wrong or to teach people how to do things. First, we actually observe real practice and see how people are already doing things. Like Dr. George said, people become experts in their field, in their role, and doctors are actually mostly very skilled communicators for them to be able to do what they do every day and see so many different types of patients and adjust to them. So when we do a discourse analytics study, we actually observe a lot of authentic conversations. And there we would see things which could be seen as a performance of empathy. And I agree with the point about non-verbals as well. And that is also part of what is often included in training for things like empathy and communication skills, patient-centered skills. And as you pointed out, you can't really just learn it in a workshop, and especially an online workshop. But eventually, as you go out into clinical practice and then graduate and so on, you would be developing it. But our hope was just to start talking about these things and getting them to start thinking about these things before they actually go into their clinical years.
Mm. And you have an interesting project that I think we can talk a little bit more about after we come back from the break. My co-host, Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist, joining me for our Doctor in the House show this Friday afternoon. And we are also speaking to Dr. Aisha Syed, senior lecturer at the Faculty of Languages and Linguistics at University of Malaya, and Stephanie Hui, a second-year dental student. We're discussing empathy, whether you can teach it, what difference does it make for patient care? And like I said, this interesting project that Dr. Aisha did with the dental students at UM. So stay tuned to Health and Living, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Xiaoyik, and my co-host, Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist. For our Doctor in the House show today, we're discussing empathy. How do we train medical professionals to develop empathy? Or nicely, summed up by George at the beginning of this show as part of the three A's, which George, you said it was something that you carried with you after a mentor taught it to you. The three A's are being affable, being available, and being able. And I like how being able is...
it's actually low down,
yeah.
But most of us would assume that in order to be good skilled doctors, it's all about how you operate, exactly. how you dispense your knowledge, your basis and that sort of thing. But if you're skilled and expert in everything, but you can't convey that information, you don't understand what the patient needs, and then it equals to nothing.
Absolutely. And patients are often, at that point, so helpless, so vulnerable, afraid of what news they're going to get, afraid of the treatment or the surgical procedure that you're going to tell them that they need, right? So that affability, that empathy that we've been talking about is what helps patients to move along their treatment journey. But just very quickly, Aisha, we've been talking about empathy between healthcare providers and the patients, and of course, expanding a little beyond that to their family and caregivers. But what about health empathy within the healthcare fraternity? I just wanted to touch on that a little bit because we've been hearing quite a fair bit about the culture, you know, in hospitals or rather the culture within medical professionals and whether there might be bullying going on. Where does health empathy come in there?
Sensitive topic.
Yeah. We don't shy away from the sensitive topics.
That's why we're BFM.
Well, firstly, I'm not a clinical person, right? So I have to just get that out there.
Yeah, but from a link, again, from the communication and the language perspective, right?
Yeah, I think we don't have a lot of focus in Malaysia on interprofessional discourse. So again, it's not, I'm not speaking so much language-wise, you know, like it's this word or that word, but language is an action. What are we doing when we talk to someone, when we ask someone their opinion, when we nod, you know, when they're telling a story or when we repeat after them and we show that we're interested and we care, what are we actually doing with our actions? And there's very little research in our Malaysian context on interprofessional discourse, especially between junior and senior health professionals. And I think if we want to know more about what kind, you know, how are people doing empathy among the medical fraternity, we would have to kind of look at that interaction first and not just interview people and find out, you know, what they think about it. But we would like to see how not only empathy is being done, but how mentorship and apprenticeship, right? How they're getting professional, socialized into the profession. I think modeling is also very important. And in our project, we have clinicians involved in our project, right? Like dentists, Dr. Jacob and Dr. Shafina, and also a geriatrician from Faculty of Medicine, Dr. Koh Hui Min. And they actually, on one of the workshops, they shared their stories about one patient, which if they looking back, they would have wanted to know a bit more and not just focus on the clinical context. And I think that was quite a significant session for the students, because it wasn't just me, the linguist, and Dr. David, the linguist, but the clinicians telling them, like, I think one very powerful story Dr. Jacob shared was something about a patient who was scheduled to do a set of dentures, and he couldn't understand why that patient was not showing up. And only later he found out that the patient actually had to save money, you know, for a considerable period of time just to get there. And I think that showed, I think the students took their shift away from this clinical, that we only have to identify what's wrong with their teeth and their saliva and things like that, but we need to know, consider the whole person. And I think when senior doctors share things, especially things which may not always put them in a heroic light or a very expert light, I think that would really help to build that kind of relationship between the senior and junior clinicians.
Shall we, you know, I'm glad you kind of like, you know, highlighted a senior person, you know, express a little bit of vulnerability or what they've done wrong. However, I'm quite keen to listen to Stephanie to see, obviously there's a lot in the press about bully and then, you know, I mean, how do you feel about your journey forward into your medical career and dental career? And is there anything that you think that doctors, senior doctors can do better as far as interprofessional communications? Is there anything that you think that we can do better as more senior person to communicate better so that the teaching itself become more effective?
Yes, there's definitely a way which I think as educators, maybe they could include their own experiences during their teaching, like to not just mentioning the theory behind it, but to tell us that we can relate this theory into our real life situation by mentioning their own past experiences, because I believe that the educators have more experience than us as a student that still is learning. Therefore, we really need the experiences from the senior lecturers to guide us and motivate us to achieve our better self mm-hmm. and motivate us to keep going and to be determined.
Just like what Dr. Aisha early on highlighted, what Dr. Jacob highlighted, you know, and in his own journey, and then showing that, you know, we're all human, and then sometimes facing error and also dealing with mistakes can be a good way of showing examples so that you don't fall into the same mistake again in the future, right?
Now, Aisha, tell us a little bit about that project. I mean, you've given a glimpse of who was involved in it and sort of what were some interactions. But, you know, a few steps back, what was this project meant to achieve?
This project was part of this interdisciplinary research grant at UM. And our project, the one that we're talking about, is part of a larger project which is trying to test ways to develop a curriculum that can help create more humanistic dentists. I know that sounds like a lofty aspiration, but we're trying to go beyond just focusing on the clinical skills and things like that. So in our sub-project, we tested out this life story documentation task, and we got the dental students were tasked to interview an older adult, and they did this in pairs, and they were tasked to interview the older adult and retell their life story. So partly in a written narrative, like an essay type writing, but also in a visual kind of bio. So they had to work with an older person, and this is all online because it happened during the pandemic. And the output, we published an ebook of 8 of these stories. But it's not so much the output that was the end goal, right? It was the actual process. These intergenerational type tasks have been used quite a lot in soft skills development, empathy training, and things like that in health sciences. And the idea is to get them to connect with an older person who's a stranger and not their grandma or one of their aunts or uncles. And I think not just interviewing them and hearing and understanding their stories, but having to retell them really makes you have to understand it, right? Like Dr. George was saying earlier about active listening. You can't really rewrite this story if you haven't been paying attention, right? So I think that put them in the position where they really had to try to get certain types of information out of the older person, understand their view, and also get their approval on the end result. So some of the adults, the older adults were very, very specific about what they wanted, and some, you know, were a bit more relaxed. So I think that process also taught them how to deal diplomatically and work out things with somebody who's a stranger. So maybe Stephanie wants to add on to this.
Yeah, Stephanie, why don't you take us a bit through what you did and what did you find difficult while you were doing it?
All right. I still remember reading about this interesting project message in our class WhatsApp group. And I was reluctant to join at first due to my heavy workload, but immediately signed up for it once I got to know that it was held during my semester break. And to be honest, I aim to improve my communication skills with the elderly after this study, and that I'm aware that communicating to the older adult is quite a challenging thing that requires patience and empathy. And also, me and my partner, Wan Yu, his name is Wan Yu, were assigned to interview Mr. George initially, but due to some miscommunication, it did not turn out well. But thanks to Dr. Aisha for her guidance, and we have another interviewee for us as a backup. She is Madam Rosla. And Madam Rosla is very friendly and bubbly adult. And although I doubted myself after our first interviewee incident, but Madam Rosla surprised us with her happy-go-lucky personality that really cheers us up during the interview session. And she has been really responsive since day one. And my favorite thing about Madam Rosla is a bright smile and cheerful laughter. And this interview is more like a chit-chat session for me. And we are really blessed to have her as our interviewee.
So, Aisha, what about perhaps some students who perhaps had a more challenging task? Did you hear of any of their struggles when it came to, you know, that aspect of communication?
Well, one of the limitations of our project was because it was done in the pandemic and we had to actually source or get older adults to participate. So most of them were like patients of the clinicians. So I guess they were mostly quite easy to handle. And, you know, people who want to be involved in this type of project anyway tend to like talking to younger people and things like that. But looking at the vlogs, because the students submitted vlogs and some of the challenges that they had, one is trying to manage the conversation if it goes off topic, and that is also sometimes a challenge that clinicians have in consultations, right? You want to let the patient talk, but you don't have all that time to, you know, divert into long things. So I think it gave them some understanding or exposure to dealing with that. But one thing I think I noticed in a few of the vlogs was they felt very uncomfortable when unpleasant or sad tales were brought up. And I think that links a lot to empathy, right? Because sometimes you're not being unempathetic, but because you feel awkward, this awkward feeling came out a lot in the vlogs. And how do we train them better to know how to deal with the awkward awkward feeling or when something negative comes
awkward
up?
Awkward silences.
Or they say like something bad happened, so I don't want to ask more about that bad thing. But if you change the subject, then it's a little bit like kind of uncaring, right? And this might happen in real conversations, whether clinical or everyday. And I think that's an area where we could focus more for the training. How do we deal with this when someone brings up something bad? Because generally, socially, we want everything to stay happy, right? So when we hear something bad, we don't know how to respond. So I think that's one gap which we would want to work on moving forward.
Actually, George, I do want to ask you, in your specialty, you deal with some of the most difficult questions.
Indeed.
Yeah, because, you know, you have to talk to men about sexual health problems. How do you see empathy coming in terms of opening up those conversations and getting them to admit to whatever is troubling them?
Yeah, I mean, in my line of work, it can range from, you know, discussion about infertility down to cancer, you know, end of life, palliative care, and then also sexual health. And sexual health probably is the most difficult one because ego, stigma, you know, culture and all these things to bring up something that you are suffering in, you know, in the bedroom, it's not an easy thing. I think one of the things that you need to assure the patient is all very professional. You know, one of the ways I deal with it is actually clinicalize the situation. Basically, you know, your sexual health is part of your bodily health. You ask about how's your appetite, and then how is your bowel habits, your urination pattern, and your sexual activities. So when you do that, you assure the patient that you are taking it very seriously, very professionally, and it is part of your overall health that I'm taking care of, and I'm really not in any way judging or in any way belittling anything that you think might not be so serious.
Yeah. So that's interesting. In a way, you are. Am I? And Aisha, do jump in if I'm perhaps getting the linguistics of this wrong. But does it sound like in some situations you want to actually move away from being too personal?
Correct. Yeah. One of the things that I learned myself is that, you know, when you talk about empathy, then you say to patients that I understand, right? And it's like, you know, it's difficult to understand that, you know, whether somebody actually suffers from sexual dysfunction, and try to make it personal to say that, look, I also have the same problems or something like that. Then that becomes, you know, hey, it's about me. It's not about you, right? It's almost the same as depression. You know, whenever it's someone who's really not well-trained to do that, whenever someone is telling you about all the troubles, all the hard time they're going through, and then you suddenly jump in and say, oh, let me tell you about my problems. And then that actually is not shifting the focus away from that patient. And so that's something I learned over the many, many years, that actually is letting the patient have the stage and then actually letting the patient to discuss their problem and don't make it personal and make it a clinical professional stage. Platform for them to discuss this.
All right. Aisha, any thoughts there?
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I think that, you know, how we do empathy daily in daily conversations, there will be a difference between that and how we would do it in a clinical context, because the clinician has a different role, right? As Dr. George said, the patient is the one on the center stage here. So those things where you have to share your own view, that might work in your friend, you know, mm-hmm. conversation with friends, but definitely being we can show that we are interested without us sharing, right? I think the doctor will still have to stay in the role of the doctor. So yeah, I would agree mm-hmm. with that.
All right.
So I'm quite interested in Aisha, you know, your project obviously involving patients, the real life patient to discuss this. And a lot of patients are quite shy in coming forward to, you know, to do this. One thing that I learned, and which has been very effective, but I think not really utilized so much, is actually using actors and actresses. Because one communication skill event or activity that I went through was at my own final year exams. As I mentioned to you in Cambridge, that, you know, it's always very thinking about issues like communication subject as a soft subject. It's very tree huggings, and then, you know, don't really kind of go down there because let's deal with the real issues of academic data, right? And when it came to my real exams, my final exam, I actually had an actor playing the role of manic depressive patients. Right. And I found the whole thing extremely caught me by surprise. You know, it was mentioned from the beginning that this is an actor, but this actor has the cue to play a psychiatric condition. And I really found that whole experience extremely valuable. It's priceless. And I learned a lot from that actor. I think in medical school, to spend that sort of money to get actors and actresses is very, very sparse. We don't have too much of that. And I begin to see that using medical students ourselves to do that, for example, I mean, I teach problem-based learning, effectively kind of trying to look in patient's problem in totality. And one subject that we go through is on infertility. And I, as a lecturer, have to play a role of one of the infertile men who comes to discuss this. And I don't even pretend that I know what it feels like to be an infertile man. I'm not an actor myself. I really think that under that circumstance, when the medical school has the resources to employ actors and actresses, that will really bring up a lot of essence of how to communicate effectively. What do you think about that, Aisha?
Firstly, for acting, you know, these role play activities have actually been used quite a lot in these types of soft skills and empathy training tasks when people are trying to test them out. So they do have students have a card, and this is your situation, and that might help them see.
To some extent.
Yeah, to some extent. But the simulated patients or standardized patients, I think they're quite commonly used for the medical exams, for their, I think their final year exams and things like that. Even at UM, we have them. And they're not actors, they're not professional actors, but they've been trained over the years. and they know, like, if it's a hypertension case, they already know, like, what kind of symptoms and things like that. So I think around the world, these are used because we can't put students in real context. But for research, we tend to prefer, I mean, from my perspective, we would want to work with actual interactions because then we can see how it's being done in the real world, and that would help us find areas that we can improve on. But in some very sensitive areas, there are studies which have only looked at simulated consultations, like in the context of open disclosure, where, you know, the doctor has to talk about a medical error with patients. And these are very sensitive things, and there are legal and ethical implications of recording authentic interactions. So there, definitely, if we can't get the authentic ones, then the acted ones also give us some viewpoint into what might be some of the issues in communication and what might be some of the ways we can overcome them.
Are these kind of simulated videos or YouTubes, are they available for students like Stephanie, kind of like gain access to them and continue to brush up on their skills? You know, perhaps this is something that in the future, Stephanie, I don't know what you think about that, because the world obviously is digitalized, and even medical school has to kind of like, go along with that. Do you think something like all these scenarios played out actually may be useful for you, perhaps in your spare time, if you have any, to brush up on that communication skills?
Actually, I've known some of my medical friends that they actually share some of the movies that are related to some sort of disease or something like the Fault in Our Stars.
Mm.
Yeah, this kind of movie. And I think that's one of their assignments to share, to publicize it on social medias and to create awareness. And that actually, I think, is quite a good move to let us as a student to expose, to have more exposure in this kind of sort of medical
What a
field.
Great idea. Getting some clips from what people do well and what people don't do so well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think what I want to come to after we come back from the break would be, do you even have time to spend with patients to do all these active listening and the relating and being able to ask them questions to find out more? Do you even have time to do that, especially in the public health sector? Mm-hmm. So we'll quickly get to that when we come back from the break. My co-host, Dr. George Lee, in the studio with me, and we're speaking to Dr. Aisha Syed, Senior Lecturer at the Faculty of Languages and Linguistics at University of Malaya, and Stephanie Hui, a second-year dental student. They are weighing in on how do we make sure that healthcare professionals impart empathy in their interactions and their care of their patients. So stay tuned, Health and Living, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Xiao Yik. My co-host joining me, Dr. George Lee, consultant neurologist, who has left us with three A's for this show today to remember: being affable, being available, and being able. I'm very sure you tick all those three A's, George, but what we're interested in is do most of our healthcare professionals practice this, right? Especially the empathy part. And are our medical students amply prepared as well to express empathy, to be able to communicate well with their patients when they begin to practice medicine after they graduate? So we're speaking to a second-year dental student, Stephanie Hui, and we're also speaking to Dr. Aisha Syed, Senior Lecturer at the Faculty of Languages and Linguistics at University of Malaya. Just very quickly, this pairing came about because Dr. Aisha at her faculty had conducted a project last year that got together some second-year dental students. Or was it first year then?
First and second year. And the project was a collaboration with the three faculties, dentistry, linguistics, and medicine.
And the project was basically to get students to interview older adults, to get their life stories, and then to rewrite it. And that's where you can practice the principles of, you know, all of that, understanding the patient's perspective, knowing how to ask open-ended questions, and, you know, all the aspects of the discourse that you were talking about. But, you know, that's all very well and nice in a safe,
ideal,
you know, when you're a student. But really, in real clinical practice, and George, you've been in a public hospital as well. Do you even have time to be affable, you know, and empathetic?
Yeah, we talk about affable and available. This is a part where it's available. I mean, I think the Brits has done some statistics that actually looked at, on average, how long is each consultation? And it worked out that each consultation is something like 7 minutes. Mm. And then also they worked out that how long will a doctor interrupt a patient before the patient actually, you know, from the moment patient opened their mouth. And then so that, you know, the active listening is all well and good, but before the patient even, have a chance, it's only like something like 30 seconds before they're interrupted.
30 seconds.
So this is exactly what we're talking about, that ideal, but yet you want to see as many patients as possible. How do you spread out that resources? I think you're absolutely right. in the ideal world, it is good. But the thing is that there are always other ways for you in order to do that. So apart from that consultation itself, there's always other things that you can do, like the blood tests and everything that actually can incorporate in that. And the care doesn't end in that consultation, because the care goes beyond the consultation. I really think that treating the patient in totality, although that consultation, the time is very limited, the care actually is beyond that. And then that has to be a communication that is an ongoing, not just between the face-to-face consultation.
Mm. And Aisha, in the work that you do with healthcare discourse, you know, do you look at how you accommodate the stress, you know, and the workload and all of that, and help the healthcare providers to still be able to communicate effectively in under 10 minutes?
Well, I don't deal with the psychometric aspects or psychological aspects because I'm a discourse analyst, so I'm looking at the interaction. But we are still working on this project that was funded by the Academy of Family Physicians. And we're trying to study, we have like about 200 primary care consultations at the at UMMC. And we're trying to see how much time in the consultation is spent on different types of tasks to find areas where we can maybe, you know, like reduce the workload on the doctor, and especially at the hospital. There's a lot of time in the consultation that's spent on administrative things, you know, filling in the form. And that might, there might be ways to take that load off the doctor where they could spend time doing other things. Secondly, there are things that you're going to do anyway. You're going to listen to your patient. I mean, if you're not going to interrupt them in 30 seconds, but you're going to listen. So why not listen while making eye contact, right? So there are smaller things that you can do that may not necessarily add on to the consultation time. Now, I read somewhere that the average time that they're recommended to spend, especially in this high volume type of situations in public healthcare, I think it's 10 minutes. But, you know, they do have a buffer, like they do tend to go over or under, and some consultations are very routine and they might take less time. So even though time is limited, I think that like Dr. George said, it's not just that interaction in that room, but it happens in a context. And if we can be empathetic and patient-centered in other ways, like about the waiting time or how they're being talked to at the counter and the kind of communication they get from the hospital and other things, that would all add together to be the whole patient experience. So maybe we can compensate in other aspects, like what Dr. George is saying, if we don't have that much time.
Stephanie, from your point of view, I mean, as a dental student, second year, you're already dealing with a heavy academic load, right? And, you know, it's only going to get, you know, more challenging. And when you're out in the field itself, you know, it's a whole new ball game, right? How do you deal with juggling the stress and still trying to think about the fact that at the end of the day, the patient in front of you will be somebody's child or somebody's elderly parent, and you have to put your, you know, according to George's 3 A's, you have to put your abilities last. In fact, even though you spent however many years in university training that last A, your abilities, when you actually see a patient, then you have to sort of flip it around and turn on a different side of yourself. What do you think, Stephanie?
Actually, I think that being as a professional dentist, in my view, that communication is really, really important, because we are not just a dentist. We are like their small makeover artists, that we actually have the responsibility to understand the reason why they seek for our help.
Stephanie, I want you to be my dentist.
No, smile makeover artist. That's lovely.
Yeah, because yeah, we actually don't just treat their teeth, and then we actually have to understand what the problems they are facing, how they expect the outcome would be, and maybe what encouraged them to really seek for our help. And in my opinion, as a ideal dentist, we have to be caring enough and to build a strong rapport with our patients, because our patients' trust and confidence means a lot to us. And we are deemed successful only if the patients are satisfied with the result and satisfied with us too.
Absolutely. You know, I'd like to wrap up here. Perhaps I can get some final takeaway messages from each of you. Stephanie, what would your final takeaway be when it comes to this issue of empathy?
I just want to urge urge everyone, especially the younger generation, to take the initiative to interact with their older relatives of even older adults, because communicating with older adults is not like a difficult task, but it's more like a friend-to-friend talk that we could actually learn a lot from their past experiences and really learn a lot from them. Yeah.
And Aisha?
I think, first of all, I would hope that the project, especially for the 17 students involved, will get them thinking a bit more about interaction and communication, whether it's the words or how they pay attention to people and talk to them, not just as dentists with their patients, but generally, I think, outside. And about listening to the stories of older adults, you know, a lot of us have older people in our family, and sometimes, I've heard this story 100 times, but it's not the information that we're trying to get, right? It's that connection sometimes when we listen to each other's stories. And I think beyond healthcare, just as people, sometimes we need to think more about that, right? And not just the informational outcome. And that can probably help us, you know, get along a bit better. So I think that's what I would say.
George?
Well, actually, you know, we've moved a long way since my matriculation time 32 years ago in 1990, from my dinosaur days of actually, you know, learning academically, all that ability. But we have come to accept that actually and also embrace, you know, communication is key. I just want to part with one key statistic. A vast majority of medical litigation comes from breakdown in communications. And then if you think about that, then you realize that vital affability communication is the key.
Absolutely. That's the best way to end this, because at the end of the day, you need to protect yourself and protect your patients at the same time. And a misplaced word, right? Or just not...
will land you a big medical
mistake. Or just not paying attention, lapsing in your attention or being neglectful for a moment.
And all that ability you've learned in medical school will all be wasted.
Okay, that's a very important note to end on then. Thank you so much for speaking to me today. My co-host, Dr. George Lee, of course, and Dr. Aisha Syed, Senior Lecturer, Faculty of Language and Linguistics at University of Malaya, and Stephanie Hui, Sankey Year dental student. This has been Health and Living, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.